This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Beyond the Uniform is committed to helping military veterans succeed in their civilian career. In order to further our mission, we're launching a 2018 pledge drive. But rather than asking for donations, we're asking for reviews. If you have benefited from this show, please pay it forward by leaving us a positive review on Apple Podcast. There's a link in every episode's show notes, or just Google Apple Podcasts Beyond the Uniform, and it's the number one link. Our goal between now and December 31st is to get to 150 reviews. As a way of saying thank you, we're going to pick our favorite review and send you a free copy of every Beyond the Uniform publication. That's Veterans in Consulting and Veterans at Goldman Sachs, two soft cover books, as well as printouts of our five ebooks. More importantly, your review will help us get this show in front of more members of the armed forces and military veterans. Thanks and enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and my goal is to help military veterans succeed in their civilian career. Today's episode number 208 with Timothy Mossholder.
So the process for me from initiating contact with these recruiters to getting to a point where I was actually in the fight doing job interviews was kind of a long process of going through and doing some self-discovery. They had some workbooks and really getting access to the resources that these recruiters put on the table. Because first and foremost, there's a whole vocabulary lesson that I wasn't aware of. Things that, you know, terms and job descriptions and even industries that I would not have necessarily have been aware of prior to jumping into this.
Well, today's interview is a little bit different than normal. We start off with a typical interview where I talk with Timothy about his own career path and what he's up to now, which is helping a lot of military veterans find their ideal job. And so we focus on that for the first segment of this interview. And then after that, I actually switch over to a previous conversation Tim and I had, because Tim has his own podcast that is similar to Beyond the Uniform, but we connected about a month ago and just chatted through some common things that we've seen and insights we've found about having done 200 Beyond the Uniform episodes and 100 of Tim's podcast, over 100 interviews for him. So between us, over 300 different interviews, and it was a really great conversation. I walked away appreciating, respecting, and really enjoying my time with Tim, and wanted to have him on the show. So be sure to check out his show. You can find a link in the show notes. And with that, let's dive into my conversation with Tim. Joining me today in Chesapeake, Virginia is Tim Mossholder. Tim, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, thanks, Justin. I appreciate it.
So for listeners, a little bit of context before I give you a brief bio on Tim. Tim and I connected about probably a month ago, and for his podcast, had just a conversation of comparing notes on what we're seeing and just overall reflections on the entire military veteran transition space, and really loved Tim and his perspective and the wealth of knowledge he brings to the space. So we're going to do something different today, which is we're going to start with a traditional interview. I'll give you Tim's background. We'll learn a little bit more about his path to his current career. And then we're going to transition into the original conversation Tim and I had, where it was more of just a chat over a beer about different observations. And I think that both pieces of this will be really interesting. But the first transition part will be the shorter of the two aspects. So for context, Tim works at Bradley Morris. He works as in their digital candidate outreach, but he also hosts their podcast, where he's produced over 116 different episodes. He started out at the Naval Academy, after which he served as a surface warfare officer for over 6 years, serving aboard the destroyer, the USS Barry, which is a destroyer. He worked for Bradley Morris for over 5 years, and he also works at MBA Veterans in their candidate marketing and digital marketing. And so, Tim, first to start off, let me give space if there's anything I got wrong on the bio or intro or anything to add to that.
Yeah, nothing you got wrong per se. Just to maybe flesh out a little bit of what I've been doing since the military, I left through the medical board process and did not have kind of, a career plan in mind when I found out that I wasn't eligible to continue to serve on the active duty, and was recruited by Bradley Morris initially in the days when we were a hiring conference company mostly. And a vast majority of our placements came from bringing folks in to monthly events around the nation where candidates would sit down with hiring managers, directors of hiring, major kind of players in the decision-making chain for any given role, and try to sit down and do multiple interviews in a single day. And what we found recently is that we needed to expand our product offerings and really get out of that, go to a hotel once every 5 to 6 weeks model. And so where I've been able to grow with the company and to see us really expand and really broaden my skill set has been bringing in Recruit Military, one of our sister companies, one of our larger competitors that ran a job board and does a series of about 170 job fairs around the nation. And that was an acquisition that allowed us to really push that in-person product to a set of team members internally that were managing that a lot more well and kind of putting together a more robust offering for our clients. So that's sort of a side company that we also co-manage. And then recently we acquired MBA Veterans. That was the brain product of two different MBA graduates who had started the company about 10 years ago as a way to introduce transitioning veterans who were finishing either their first or second year of an MBA from a top 75 school to the hiring managers and the folks at corporate America that wanted to hire MBAs, but also wanted to hire a veteran and needed a unique way to go do that all in one fell swoop. And so that's neat because that's sort of an entrepreneurial effort that we brought into our corporate portfolio. And I get to work on it almost kind of in the same way where we are very much bootstrapping to get that thing put together. And although it's been around for 10 years, the digital marketing, the candidate communication, the advertising, and all the work that goes into making that a successful event with lots and lots of job seekers and veterans there, that's something that has always continued to evolve and change over time. Social media marketing is not a static thing that you just figure out one time once and then you just keep doing it. So we're learning all kinds of new tips and tricks as we bring that into our portfolio and kind of bring those folks into the fold.
That's great. I mean, a couple things just to point out for listeners. First of all, I think your story's not uncommon in kind of, it sounds like it was an unexpected transition that you faced. It was maybe earlier than you had anticipated due to medical reasons. And I feel like a good number of guests I had on the show were in a similar situation, which is just a reminder that, to always be ready for that transition, to always be thinking about what you're going to do next, because you never know when that might happen. Even though, in general, the military is a pretty secure job, for there are those military exceptions. And then I love to hear the amount of innovation it sounds like Bradley Morris is doing and changing with the times and making two acquisitions in the space to be able to broaden their product offering. And I imagine that's been exciting for you to be at the forefront of that, of seeing these changes and pioneering a lot of them.
Yeah, well, when I started here, Bradley Morris was an owner, founded, and operated business. Sandy Morris was the CEO, and she's since retired. And that change has really changed our business model in a lot of ways. We've got some outside investment from some firms that are actually mostly veterans themselves, and that's helped us to really be able to take a big holistic look at the market and say, okay, where do veterans and companies come together? Where do veterans and schools come together? Where do veterans and nonprofits come together? How do we bring these different elements of the world that, folks are looking for access to because they're no longer in or they're not going to get to be in the active duty military? And so seeing that go from, one type of model, one kind of way, and then over 6.5 years be, not a totally different thing, but a different thing in a clear and obvious way. The candidate experience, I think, has improved. The quality of the feedback and the number of candidates we're placing has gone up drastically. And if you only used one measurement to define our success, and you call that measurement the number of candidates accepting job offers because of the work we do here, that's gone up so significantly that, I mean, you really have to be honest and call these changes almost unilaterally good because we're helping a lot more people connect with a lot more employment opportunities than we did back in the past.
And take us back when you were initially facing that transition. You talked about being recruited by Bradley Morris, but what was that like? So you kind of have this, I'm guessing, unexpected career change. How did you approach your first job search, and how did you get connected with Bradley Morris and decide to give that a go?
Well, I was stationed at Surface Forces Atlantic in the Norfolk area, specifically in the N-47 Directorate, which was the Cruiser and Destroyer Material Readiness Team. And that was led by a captain who had previously held command of the USS San Jacinto. So he kind of knew the ins and outs of cruiser destroyer readiness and maintenance. And one of the lieutenants in that office was separating and had recently taken a job as a recruiter working for, Navy officers in the local area with a competitor to Bradley Morris. And so this person was coming and going from the office, had all the promo materials. So that was my first exposure to what a recruiting firm did. And as I was, completing this stash job, one of my classmates and actually company mates from the Naval Academy reached out to me and introduced herself and said, "Hey, I'm working at a recruiter as well, and we knew each other from school." So we had that conversation early on of just to understand what recruiting was. And at the time, what it essentially was queuing you up to come to a hiring conference, like I've mentioned, where that face-to-face interaction was the primary way to break down boundaries between what hiring managers were looking for in new employees and what military veterans had to offer. And you had to kind of sit down and make eye contact and shake hands and really break the ice in order to get to that substantive part of the discussion where you could tell them why you were a good fit for this process engineering role or sales role or consulting job that, maybe you didn't have a whole lot of subject matter expertise about. So the process for me from initiating contact with these recruiters to getting to a point where I was actually in the fight doing job interviews was kind of a long process of going through and doing some self-discovery. They had some workbooks and really getting access to the resources that these recruiters put on the table. Because first and foremost, there's a whole vocabulary lesson that I wasn't aware of. Things that, terms and job descriptions and even industries that I would not have necessarily have been aware of prior to jumping into this. So that was really the first hurdle for me was figuring out, what is this language I need to speak that's business? What kind of stability would these different options offer me in terms of compensation and lifestyle and work-life balance? And then when we got to the point where I had my orders in hand and I really knew my timeline and understood when I could commit to something in terms of, availability to start work, that's when things got out of that training and sort of mentorship phase and got more into the operations phase of being presented with interviews and being suggested, hey, you should court this company or that company. And so that to me was a scary process. And what I didn't realize at the time was that it's definitely a learn by doing sort of thing. And I had thought that much like in the military, I'd accomplish some set of training milestones. I'd read all the modules. I'd watch the video. I'd do the workbook, and then and only then, once I was totally ready to sit down and just smash the ball out of the park into the parking lot, that's when I'd start interviewing. And the fact of the matter was is that Bradley Morris sort of threw me into some interviews and said, "Look, we get it. This isn't the best thing you've ever heard of in your whole life, but you have to go do these interviews, right? It's necessary to get the reps before you'll be able to do the heavy lift on the job that you're dreaming of and that you've always wanted." And that was the kind of cathartic moment for me of realizing, okay, hey, this is what this is all about, right? It's about this human connection and interactivity and being able to talk to people and really get down to what they need to have done. Because I found in a lot of the interviews I did, there was a job description for sure. But when you ask them, okay, let's go behind this and figure out what's happening at this company and what sorts of things prompted you to want a veteran and what about, my time in the Navy seems relevant, there weren't a whole lot of hard answers there. And there were some soft answers. Well, we think that this would be neat, and we suspect that these are some areas where you could add some value. And it really came down to me having the confidence to have that conversation and say, you know what, I don't know if this is the best fit. And out of the seven interviews I did on my very first hiring conference at Bradley Morris, I felt like three or four of them really weren't the best fit. But just like, in romantic relationships, right? I mean, theoretically, they'll all be a failure except for the last one. And then that's the one. And then, you go off and you follow that pursuit. So in my case, one of my last interviews was with Bradley Morris. And I'd had a couple of these conversations and relied heavily on my talking points and the stuff that I'd scripted out and really thinking to myself, okay, how do I ingest this question and in real time sort of come up with a really elegant sounding answer that relies upon some good empirical evidence that I can pull from a fit rep or from a, an awards write-up or something like that. And the interviewer, who's now the current CEO of Bradley Morris sort of sat me down and said, all right, lean back, because I had been doing the whole front 3 inches of the chair thing all day. He let me take my jacket off and he said, okay, I'm not here to cross-examine you. You're not, under oath. Let's discuss what is going to be in your best interest for the immediate future as far as your career is concerned and in terms of what we want. And so, again, that to me was that interesting insight into a company that wasn't necessarily operating off this script. There wasn't some incongruity between, hey, this is normally we'd go to UCLA and hire a mechanical engineer, but now we're talking to you instead. It was a conversation about how we could come to sort of mutual benefit by working together, not just, plugging me into a hole that was open. And that was and remains today kind of a defining moment in terms of how I evaluate employment opportunities and where I saw myself transitioning, because I knew that even if it wasn't a specific set of responsibilities on a day-to-day basis, and it was, and there are with, any job, I was working with a company that was looking to develop me just as much as they were looking for me to develop them. And so that kind of structured my viewpoint in terms of the other interviews I'd done and follow-on interviews I did after that before ultimately deciding to accept the offer here.
I love so much of what you said, but the one I'll just jump on is I just really appreciate that perspective of getting the reps in. There's no approximation for the actual interview process, and then really evaluating the person interviewing you and that company just as much as they're evaluating you. And I think that there can be this temptation, especially for that first job out of the military, to just get, get something in hand and go with it. And I love the measured approach you took of taking your time to really figure out what was the best opportunity for you. And I respect the approach that sounds like the CEO of Bradley Morris took with you of let's just have a frank conversation on what's best for your career and also what's best for us as a company. And if those align, then there's a good opportunity. But if not, it's not worth either of your time going into it. So I think that's a great, great approach. How have things changed? Could you talk a little bit more about your current role and maybe it's interesting because you've got, it seems like so many balls in the air. You've got so many different things that you do. Could you walk us through what your day looks like and how you balance your time between all of these different activities?
Yeah. Well, let me first and just kind of cover what my initial set of responsibilities were when I first started, because I think it's interesting to counterpose that to what I do now. The first thing I did was basically they set me up with a laptop and access to the candidate database, and that candidate database has a manual entry where people can go in and build candidate records as they have conversations with job seekers. It's also got a capture mechanism to pull in data from our forms on our websites where people fill out applications and then we can work with them. And the basic idea I had thought kind of going into it was I'd open up this database just full of eager, excited job seekers all waiting by their telephones, just thinking, when is Tim Mossholder going to dial my 10-digit phone number so that I can get that job that I'm eagerly waiting for? And the fact of the matter was there was a lot more to initiating that communication than I had thought going into it. I made my first cold call, I think, sometime in late March of 2012. And I remember distinctly at the time, I think I was 27 when I started there, hearing my voice crack as I left that forced voicemail, like a teenager calling his first, date in high school, like, hi, is Sally there to go out? And that really cemented for me this notion that the skill I had to develop in order to succeed at this job was this ability to kind of rip through this really comfortable conversation with people that had a goal in mind, right? And when you talk to your friends, you're not necessarily trying to get them to do any one thing at any one moment. And in a lot of cases, the conversation is sort of natural and fluid. And so I had to figure out, how do I balance not wasting this person's time, for sure, right? We got to get to the point. Also with not wasting my time, because I want to find out, are they really interested? Are they kind of on the fence? If they're on the fence, there's a way to talk to that person, a specific pathway, whether that's, hey, you sound like you're busy. Let's, send you some materials, set up a time in 2 weeks for you to give me a call back. I'll mark it on my calendar. You mark it on yours. We'll make a commitment to each other. And that just this narrative conversation needed to evolve very fluidly and in real time, where I'm understanding, hey, this is what this person does or doesn't want to do. And there were times when early on, I didn't know whether I could help somebody. And so I'll apologize to those folks 5.5 years ago that thought, hey, maybe Tim Mosholder didn't do the best job possible helping you find work. It took me a while to figure out, well, what is the connection here I can make where, I'm on the telephone with Joe Smith, candidate who's interested in this, that, and the other thing, and then there's the right client in our portfolio, the right event to attend. And so over, about 6 months, I started to get my feet underneath me, started to make placements, and the guy that was managing the community of nuclear-trained officers worldwide, he himself was a nuke SWO, he got contacted by his reserve detailer who said, your 2-year deferment for deploying with the reserves is coming to a close. I need to mobilize you. And they managed to sort of do a horse trade where he got to do that in Norfolk, and he didn't actually have to go overseas or go down to Florida to Tampa, which was kind of a common destination at the time. And we were facing this, big shortfall of not having somebody to handle all of the officers coming off of submarines and carriers. And so I stepped into that role, and having come from talking to pilots and EOD guys and other SWOs, that was a very different conversation. It was more different than I had thought it would be, especially because the training pipelines to get to a nuclear-powered submarine or aircraft carrier are drastically different than the training pipeline to become a surface warfare officer. So I had to relearn this whole skill set of communication and how to, sort of put a point on what I was trying to go after. And so after about 3.5 years with the firm, I'd been doing that then, I guess, for about 3 years at that point, I went to leadership and I said, I think I know enough about what we're doing here. I want to try to change some of what we have on the shelf programmatically throughout the company. And as a, an English major at the academy and somebody who, I kind of value my communication style, I thought that I'd picked up a lot of data points that would allow me to do that, at least for the officer candidates we work with. So started digging into some of our training resources and got out of that direct one-on-one consulting and mentorship and moved more into how does this company as a whole communicate its intent, its desires, its goals to its candidates in this very specific kind of methodology that we've employed in order to, make enough candidates show up at hiring conferences, have enough candidates in the hopper for our non-conference jobs. And that kind of turned into a what we might call a program management job, almost sort of like a command traino, working on all the different deliverables we had out there. We revised a bunch of our preparation videos. I stood up a webinar series and really started to try to think, how do we bulk communicate with people in a more effective way? And that was right around the same time that we went through Sandy's retirement. We got some outside investment and had a lot more resources that we could allocate towards things like our website, our digital advertising strategy. And so we went from a company that had a website as a way to sort of let the world know we exist to having a website that was deliberately structured to be an inbound funnel for people who are coming in either on the client side or the candidate side to do business with us and to capture their information, their interests, their desires in a way that allowed our team to act upon that. So right around this time that we're moving into more of a technology direction, we stood up an online job board for Bradley Morris in the first time ever. I was in this position where we needed somebody to tell the story of this to candidates. And so we actually segregated out from our client marketing team, the candidate communication efforts into a separate vertical. And about a year ago, well, a little bit over a year ago, I got tapped to help influence and manage that vertical. And at first I had thought, well, hey, this is going to kind of be like, sprucing up the call to action and writing more compelling email statements and trying to just, streamline this so that it sounds like it's matching the real interests and desires of what candidates have been telling me for 3.5 years they want and need from us. Ultimately, it took me in a much more technical direction of understanding how these systems interface and being able to connect these different parts within our ecosystem, which now included Recruit Military, with the Bradley Morris experience, so that folks who may have never heard of us and went to a job fair in outside Fort Riley a year ago, maybe we can enroll them somehow and get them access to these direct placement opportunities, even if, they haven't necessarily been to the Bradley Morris website and fill out an application. And so this kind of interconnectivity between our companies and in between our product lines sort of became my way of increasing the overall engagement. And that kind of leads me to what I do right now, where I consider, any successful day at work, oversight of our technology tools, oversight of our external digital presence, whether that's on marketing platforms like Facebook, Google, places like LinkedIn. We're getting ready to queue up some YouTube content so that we can get some more engagement there. YouTube being the number two highest volume search engine in the world. I didn't realize that until I heard that from one of our strategy team members here, that basically if you're in Google and you're in YouTube, you're covering the majority of your search results. So any given day now, I'm pretty much looking at all these different properties that we manage, anywhere that we're putting the message out there, whether, again, it's from our website or it's external to our website, and trying to manage how that transaction is happening with the job seeker ecosystem.
This is great. Well, we'll transition now to the conversation we had, but I want to make sure that listeners know how to follow you and get in touch with you. His podcast is called the Veteran Influencer Podcast. I'll have links within our show notes. But how else can listeners follow you and stay in touch with what you're doing?
So the biggest way to get access to the news and updates and real-time job updates that we're putting out there is to follow our pages on LinkedIn. And that would be the Bradley Morris Incorporated company page or the recruitmilitary.com company page. We've got a whole communications team that custom tailors the message on both of those platforms to really make sure that it's updated, it's lively. We've got, you know, weekly and daily posts that are putting valuable information out there. If you want to talk to me personally, my email is tmossholder, T-M-O-S-S-H-O-L-D-E-R, at bradley-morris.com. I'll gladly field inbound emails. And if you want, you're more than welcome to connect with me on LinkedIn. Timothy Mossholder on LinkedIn. There's another Tim Mossholder out there. Just make sure I'm the one that was in the Navy. And you're more than welcome to send me a connection request on there, and we can connect that way also.
Awesome. Well, we'll transition now to the conversation we had. But thanks, Tim, for joining me again on this. And we'll for listeners, we'll glide right into the previous conversation.
My pleasure, Justin.
So I had an opportunity to look through your background, and it's kind of funny. I listened to an episode, episode 92, that you did back in April with Justine Evers.
Yeah.
And I was listening to her story, and I think mine is fairly similar. I got out through the medical board process sort of out of the clear blue sky, didn't have a huge plan for that. And listening to you interview her, I was like, man, this is just like what I do on the podcast. It sounds like a very similar kind of goal of finding out what was each individual story like. So maybe you want to jump in and just give us the quick nickel tour of what you're doing right now, and then we can kind of go from there.
Yes. So I went Naval Academy, was on subs for about 5 years, and then got out, went to business school at Stanford, and started a company. So I've been in the startup space since leaving the military. But a few years ago was just reconnecting with a military friend and a bunch of other military guys, and was reminded of that pain point that I experienced, and I think most people experience, of trying to figure out what to do when you leave the military. And for me, business school was great. It gave me a lot of insight into careers I'd never heard of. But the downside was it was over $120,000 of tuition and 2 years of opportunity cost. And it just got me thinking of, like, there's got to be some scalable way to highlight, you know, to figure out what you can do after your military service. And at the time, I was listening to a lot of Tim Ferriss's podcast. And I liked his format because I thought, look, here's a way in which he doesn't have to be an expert on anything. He just has to be curious. And I thought that might be a good format. And so similar to you, just went down that path of, can I find different veterans and learn about what they do in their civilian career, how they got there, and what advice they would have for others doing the same. And part of the intention was to just shine a spotlight and show people in the military, look, these are all options that you are really well suited for, and you can do absolutely anything. At this point, I've interviewed the CEO of Pepsi and NFL players and Academy Award nominees. And my experience has been that veterans can do anything. Oftentimes, they underestimate what it takes to get that or achieve that career path, but they can certainly do anything. And so at this point, I've done about 188 interviews. And it's been a great way to reconnect with that part of my life in the military community in general.
Yeah, and that's kind of the same motivation that I came to it with, thinking to myself, how do we document what's happening in a way that people are going to actually interact with it, right? Because, I mean, I could get on the phone with candidates here at work and talk all day and night through the transition process, and we can do that individual mentorship thing. But you need a little bit broader footprint, I think, to just, like you said, understand the full range of possibilities. And having something you can stick on in the car or listen to when you're working out makes a really great way to kind of expand that volume of, like you said, individual examples there.
Totally agree. And, you know, if I'm understanding your situation, you represent, like Justine, you represent the extreme situation where you are forced to transition before you're necessarily ready or before all of your peer set and friends have transitioned. And so the resource you would have had of calling on them to learn about how they transitioned, it's almost like you have to forge your own way without any support or resources. I interviewed a guy, Timothy Avery. Tim Avery was the same way. He got out. He was Naval Academy after just a year or two, was medically disqualified. And it's kind of like the sense I got in talking to him is you're on your own. Like, you really have to bushwhack through this career field on your own and figure it out for yourself. And so I appreciate the difficulty that you must have been faced with in that. And I love that. I imagine that gives you a lot of motivation to help others, so they're not wandering in the wilderness trying to figure out what their calling is or what they want to do next.
Well, one of the big challenges that I think folks who get separated without having made the deliberate choice to leave the active duty, whatever that reason is that in I can speak to mine, and I think I can infer from my background that there's some others that feel this way. You sort of have to decide how to get excited about a civilian career if it's not what you wanted for yourself. Mm. And that's a difficult process of trying to sit down and say, and I spoke with another gentleman about this recently, you know, hey, how do I get excited about a job interview when I'm going to be, you know, doing something that I wouldn't have chosen for myself? It's not something that I had planned for. And so that redefinition of identity that happens simultaneous to also having to find out where your next meal is coming from and where you're going to live and who are the people you're going to surround yourself with when you get there, that's a real challenge. And there's, you know, there's plenty of resources out there to, you know, use the internet or veteran networks or the official government programs like Transition GPS and whatnot to actually get some of that basic rudimentary contact. But there's not a lot out there for people who say, okay, this is great, but I thought I was going to retire as the most successful CNO in the history of the United States Armed Forces. Now what do I go do? And how do I tell, you know, client X, right, Acme Incorporated, that I'm super excited to become a part of their business analysis team? It's like, well, I'm not. I want to go do something else, like drive ships.
That's awesome. That's wild. I hadn't thought of that aspect. Who was the interview? I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I did that with Robert Graves. He actually does the Year of the Vet podcast. I think he's based out of the West Coast, but he's doing a really cool internship right now at West Point, where he's working with the Corps of Cadets at their basically like their human performance lab, where they do some performance psychology. They work through a lot of the human factors stuff that gets incorporated into not just sports performance, but also what kind of inevitably becomes battlefield performance.
That's wild. I think I just saw an interview or a short video through the Pat Tillman Foundation on him. But I what I appreciate about what you're saying, I hadn't thought of the passion piece, especially like what you said about identity. That's definitely come through in a lot of the interviews of whether you realize it or not. And I didn't realize it until after I got out of the military. That experience is an incredible portion of your identity for most veterans, and having to rediscover or redefine your identity or purpose or mission, that is a common theme that I've seen in my interviews. But that the piece you touched on is one I hadn't thought of before, is the passion piece of like, how do you convincingly tell someone that you want to do a job even if that was not your first choice, or if you faced that transition unexpectedly. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of like somebody saying to you, hey, you're like it or not, you're going to eat ice cream. Now you've got to pick the flavor. Well, okay, sure, I wanted steak, but I guess we'll go do this now instead. And I sometimes try to ask myself, well, what would I be doing? Like, what would today look like for me? you know, if I didn't actually get out of the service. If for the last six something years I'd been progressing through the surface warfare career track, I'd completed the orders that I didn't get to execute when I got medboarded. And I think that there's going to be a lot of things, and I've got, you know, peers and friends that are telling me what they're doing, who have, you know, at this point now completed their department head of float tours and are moving on to that pre-XO shore duty. There's probably a large amount of stuff that I would not have loved doing, right? So that I would have said to myself, I didn't choose this. I didn't want to be here. My detailer sent me here. And so while leaving the military wasn't a deliberate choice, I also have to, you know, kind of balance this with saying, well, yeah, but, you know, how many times did I really get to pick exactly what I wanted to be doing while I was on the active duty? And so some of that angst, I think it's just sort of grass is greener syndrome sometimes. And that's something that I've seen a huge amount from candidates who work with us, and they come back into the process a few years later looking for another job, sort of saying, hey, this isn't great. And it's like, well, you know, none of it's that great, right? You got to make it great. And it's what you bring to the experience, what you bring to work. And that's something that I see folks kind of wrestle with in the first 3 to 5 years. It's very common.
I like that too. And I think it's easy for me to forget too of that, because I think very fondly of my service, and then to remember, yeah, there was a lot of time where you don't have that autonomy. You don't have that choice in what you're doing or where you're going and things like that. And so I can imagine that it's easy to, as you transition, I just like the way you put that. I thought that was great. And the thing that it made me think of is one of the favorite books I've read in the last 5 years is, and I interviewed the author for the podcast, but it's called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And the author isn't a veteran, but this was like one of those New York Times bestseller books. And the premise of his book is that one of the most harmful pieces of advice that we've given to people is to follow your passion. And we have set up this expectation that your job should be one part hobby, one part personal love affair, and that sets people up for disappointment because it's such an unrealistic expectation. And one of the things he goes through in his book is this thing he calls the craftsman mindset of, no matter what you're doing, trying to build up what he calls career capital, trying to build up tangible skill sets that you can cash in later for more autonomy or more pay or more passion or whatever else it is. And it's a much more practical and achievable tactical approach, because whatever you're doing, you can get better, and that tends to lead to more job satisfaction. And so when you were saying that, I realized that myself as well, and many of the people I've interviewed, it's frustrating sometimes, because you want to be able to go into a job interview and say, like, yes, this is, I just served my country, I was protecting freedom, and now my next thing is selling paper or inkjet cartridges or whatever else it is. But for me, at least, it removes some of the pressure, realizing, like, look, this career does not need to define me as a person. This career does not need to meet all of my needs as a human being. This is something that I want to enjoy on some level, but I want to be able to grow and learn, and growth tends to lead to more satisfaction than anything else, and is more reasonable to find than, like, this is my dream job.
Right. And I think that a lot of folks, well, let me just say this. So what you just characterized there is also snapshotted in the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Great movie.
He says in there, you know, hey, I don't understand young people today who say they want to find their passion, you know, and his whole approach to making sushi. And for those who haven't seen it, it's about this, you know, ancient sushi chef that has a restaurant in, I think, the basement of a Tokyo subway somewhere, but it's world class. I think it's one of the only, I'm going to get this wrong, 4-star, 5-star Michelin sushi restaurants in the world.
Yep.
And his whole premise is like, look, go to work and just every single day you're just working at a craft. And by the time, you know, you are as old as he is, you'll be the best there is. And if you consistently do that, that's the roadmap.
It's funny when you say that too. I realize, you know, going back to your piece about the autonomy and choice of things, it's like, well, when I was on my submarine, you know, at one point I made the damage control assistant, and I wasn't, you know, I had no choice in that as far as I remember, but it wasn't like I needed to go into that position as the division officer thinking that auxiliary division was my calling, or that was my mission in life, or that's what I always wanted. It was like, that was the job. And I worked as hard as I could to be the best that I could in that position. And it's almost like a different variety of that, of like, look, there's some choice that you have, but it's not like you need to, sometimes I think we take that too seriously.
Yeah. And so I've been reading or listening to an audiobook by Ray Kurzweil, who's sort of a futurist technologist, talking about how brains work. And the whole beginning chapter is talking about these layers of hierarchies that are, you know, physical in the brain. And one of the things that it's kind of triggering in me listening to this and thinking about all the career advice I've given over my time is that there's different hierarchies to the way you can view work, right? You know, so at some level, if somebody said, "What'd you do at work today?" I sat in a chair, I spoke in an empty room into a microphone. And nobody would tell you that, yeah, I did that for 25 years, it was great. And they're like, what are you, a crazy person? Mm. But if you said, hey, I had a really interesting conversation with a fellow alumnus from the Naval Academy. Okay, mm-hmm. Hey, we checked some boxes there. We produced recorded content that can go on the website. Well, there's another box you checked. And so as you zoom out of your hierarchies, you know, whatever it is that the task is or whatever motions you need to make, right? At the top level, I think for most people, it's this idea of being excellent at what you do. That's kind of the top umbrella that carries all of the rest of what your daily tasks are, all the way down to tie your shoelaces and don't trip walking up the stairs. And so I think if you can focus on, you know, hey, look, I might not enjoy the sitting in the chair all day and it might be a little cold in my office, I'm sitting here with a sweater on, but when I leave and I go to sleep tonight and I say, well, did I do good things? My CEO used to ask me this. He said, did you do good things for the Navy today? You know, and like he wanted a specific answer. Well, okay, so what was the specific thing I did? Well, I tried as hard as I could. And if I failed, then I failed trying hard, right? And mm-hmm. there's value in that. Or, yeah, hey, I nailed it. I knocked it out of the park today. Everything lined up perfectly, shot right through the center hole. Okay, that's even better. But at the end of the day, I worked as hard as I could. And that's the kind of thing that whatever it is you're doing, you should always take pride in that. And that's what I think is really hard to grasp getting out of the military, because when you become a civilian, like in the military, yeah, there's definitely a structure to that. And there's a framework to how you can work hard, because you go find the right book and you just read it. And, oh, there it is. Tech pub, blah, blah, blah. Tells me how to work hard at this. Mm. And that's not necessarily as true on the outside. I'm curious from your perspective, because you went into graduate school right after the submarine community, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that kind of, do you think, convert your mindset from, hey, find the instruction, read the pub, talk to the SME, then going through that crucible of kind of redefining some of your professional mindset and then becoming an entrepreneur where there was, not to say no rules, but certainly no instruction for how to make that work properly?
You know, it's interesting. I think that for me, I think, you know, it's funny saying this, because I think that Navy nuclear power is kind of, in my mind, viewed one way, which is kind of studious and studying and book smart, things like that. And I just think that I've learned more in my life just through experience and interaction and finding experts and talking with them. And so I think that that part of business school that really connected for me was being soaking aspect of just being surrounded by different people for highly concentrated periods of time in extreme activities for a lot, you know, 2 years. And in that, you just through osmosis suck in so much about the vocabulary, the understanding of career paths, the understanding of even like, you know, stupid things like, hey, this group of people over here, I don't tend to like or get along with, and this is the career path that they've chosen. So therefore, I'm probably not going to want to do that career path, things like that. I think that that's one of the things that stood out for me for business school was a lot of it was exposure. A lot of it was just learning through brushing shoulders with people. I don't know if it, I guess maybe through that it changed my thinking from, I'm trying to think about that actually, you know, was there a fundamental shift in thinking? Because I honestly, Tim, I look back on 10 years now in entrepreneurship, and I feel like so much of the success I have had is rooted in, honestly, lessons I learned at the Naval Academy. And I'm not saying that out of lip service to the military, but I think that a lot of what is most poignant from my experience in the military was the sense of breaking through mountains, like just sheer determination and a willingness to do whatever it takes to succeed. And it is a small, tiny example, but like, you know, it's 7 a.m. here in Denver. And it's like things like that, that I think that most veterans don't bat an eye at, of like, oh, okay, if I have to get up an hour early, or if I have to go do this before work, what's the big deal? Like, you can just kind of power through different things. And the business school side of things was incredible for me, for having credibility, for having like kind of a calling card, as well as a network. The network has been extremely valuable. For me, I'm not honestly sure how much of the academic learning has influenced my entrepreneurial journey. And that might just be me as a person, or it might be that that's not the pure intention of business school. But I'm kind of rambling at this point, but I feel like it's been more of the, for me, it was more the experience of meeting people than any like tangible skill set that I obtained through that grad school program.
That's kind of the exact feedback I've heard from other folks as well, in the sense that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's not to take anything away from the curriculum, but that the majority of the value of the curriculum was in facilitating those interactions, not necessarily like the new data that you included into your cognition.
Yeah, and that was just to give context, because we're all unique snowflakes and all of that, but it's like, my experience in the military too, when I look back, I don't think about the nuclear engineering I studied for submarines. I've probably forgotten all of that if I ever really understood it. And it's I remember more being officer of the deck on the midwatch, and the experience is what stands through to me, not the academic education. And I imagine there are people who are the exact opposite, where even going through business school, like the classes did make all the difference, and that did provide the value they needed, and they probably extracted way more knowledge, and they're more successful in applying it. So I don't want to play it up that there's no value there, but just for me, 10 years out, it feels like that almost all of the value for me was the people I met and the experiences I had.
And that's probably a byproduct of your life and where you've come from. And if I were to ask lots of other veterans that were high achievers in engineering degrees at the Naval Academy, they may all tell me the same thing. And in fact, my roommate went to Harvard after school. He was an aero major, and he said the same thing. And I wonder if that's just by virtue of where you come from, that element of networking and interaction is the most valuable thing that you're looking for, versus somebody who's been in that for 5 to 7 years. You know, they got out of college, they went straight to Wall Street, they went to a consulting shop, they did something that was kind of in line with where the other folks that matriculate to business school come from. And then they're there to, okay, hey, look, I've been struggling with this concept in meetings for the last, 6 months. I think I need to sit here and pay attention and get it. Whereas you're like, oh, cool, yeah, statistics, rad. I'm here to listen to this guy who started his own company that's giving the keynote tonight, right?
Yep,
then I'm
going to
get
absolutely.
With his assistant, and we're going to do a thing.
And, right. And that is one regret. That's kind of the number one thing I give, piece of advice I give to veterans considering going to particularly business school, is I got out of the Navy and I took nearly 6 months and just like traveled around Southeast Asia, and that was incredible. But I really regret that I didn't take 3 of those months and just worked somewhere. I don't think it would have really mattered where, but when I look back, my first half of my first year at business school, I was just skimming the surface of knowledge. Like, I was learning job titles, I was learning career paths, I was learning basic business vocabulary. And the price that you pay per hour to go to these schools is quite high. And I feel like if I had taken 3 months and worked in an office and gotten to know just a little bit more, I could have achieved that knowledge at a much cheaper price. Hell, I would have been paid to be doing it. And then that would have allowed me to go into these classes and drop in 3 or 4 levels deeper. And to your point, you know, that my classmates that had spent 5 years in consulting prior to business school, they were operating on a different level. Like, they were obtaining so much more and so much deeper comprehension from classes while I was just swimming in the kiddie pool in the same class.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like doing a joint tour and ending up in like, wait, we speak French at these meetings? Like, hold on a second.
Yeah. I was curious, though, you know, one thing I'm always curious when I talk with people with your background is, because I've done 188 of these interviews, but this is just on the side. And in your job, you are just interacting. I'm imagining in a few years, you're interacting with thousands of different veterans. And I'm always curious to see, like, is there any trend that you see around misconceptions? Like when you're talking to people who are on active duty, have you seen any overlapping areas where they're expecting things to be one way, but it's actually something completely different?
Yeah, I think this is tough to touch on because what I see, I think I observe various personality attributes that align to certain interests, and I see personality attributes that don't. And I try not to be judgmental about whether those are, you know, good or bad, but I do see people who I think inhibit the total volume of like successful outcomes they could experience because of these preconceptions. And so one of them I'll tell you is that I think a lot of military veterans who haven't worked in corporate America, they view companies much like a consumer would.
Mm.
And so they think to themselves, okay, what banks have I banked at? What family members have recommended things to me to invest in the stock, right? Amazon's a good stock to buy. I hear, let me apply to Amazon. And that's not a bad way to start. It's really not, because I think that if that opens the door to you finding out about all these other companies that are out there, then that's good. But if your job search strategy is to go to the career website of all the companies on your favorite NASCAR car and to see which of them sound like a great fit for, you know, a Marine helicopter pilot or a you know, Air Force missileer. Well, you're going to miss this huge section of the economy that's out there that, of course, the active duty never interacts with, but like service businesses, for example. I think a lot of people look at service businesses and they think to themselves, well, what are you actually doing there? I don't understand. What's the service? Well, you know, a service business is a company that puts out a fire for another company, right? They are the aspirin to your headache. And if you don't have those headaches, then you can't necessarily understand where the business comes from. And so I remember as a veteran, as when I was on the active duty and I pop open a company's website and I was like, what do they even do? You know, what do they sell? And it, probably the clearest example of me really not getting this was at an interview Bradley Morrissey coordinated on my behalf. And it was a job that I was really excited about because it was out in San Diego and I was living in Hampton Roads at the time. And I thought, well, this is my ticket to fun in the sun. And there was a lot of income potential. It sounded like something that was sort of cool, cutting edge technology. And I read their website and the guy who was briefing me about it said, look, you know, this guy's going to ask you to explain the business top to bottom. Here's the crib sheet where you can research, you know, the basic concepts here, know what they do, read their website, figure it out. Okay, great. And I went home and I did that. And I just did not, like you said, have the vocabulary to understand what I was looking at. And when I went in, the guy asked me the very first question, okay, so why don't you tell us in your own words what our business does? I talked for 3 to 4 minutes and thought I fleshed out my answer pretty well and, you know, put a nice little bow on the end and sat there smiling at him. He looked at me and goes, well, that's not really it. Let me tell you what we do. Right? And so I think that, you know, however amusing that was. And I think I laughed when he said that. And we both looked at each other like, all right, dude, this is over. But what it highlights to me is like how many other companies like that where I could have hit their website, I could have read their about us, I could have stalked people on LinkedIn and never really understood what it was like to work at that company, what their challenges were. There's just this whole world of questions that I probably needed to know before accepting employment that I didn't have the experience to figure out. And so sometimes folks say, hey, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do the interview because I don't get it at face value. I think that's the big thing that folks have to struggle with in order to expose themselves to the right people because, and this is my humble opinion, I don't think what the company does is very important, assuming that it's not something where you think, you know, it's causing harm to the world or whatever. But, you know, every company is really just a collection of people who have unified behind a set of common purpose, a set of common causes. And so in that sense, when you go into the job search as an active duty service member and you think about it like, you know, selecting orders or selecting a unit, imagine if you could interview every CO and then call your detailer back and say, I like these three COs the best. Let's focus my time and attention over here. I met my department head. She gave me a tour around. It was really interesting. We totally clicked. I'd like to continue pursuing that ship or that submarine. So that's the thing that I think people don't get, is that that's kind of where you're going to be. And so having that knowledge base to have an intelligent conversation, you know, where there's some informed consent about what you're getting yourself into, that's really tricky. And I think that that requires experience, and you kind of just got to jump into some stuff and try hard and see where it takes you. But it also requires a lot of research and sort of prior planning. And that's also hard to do.
I think that's great. I think that's so spot on. And I you know, I think back to, for me at the Naval Academy, the way that I chose submarines was I, you know, did one of my summers on a submarine. I did my summers doing other things and didn't enjoy it as much. And I met a ton of people, and some of the guys I met that were on submarines, we just clicked with. And that made it easier to decide amongst six different career options that I had at the time. And I think it's the exact same process, but the downside is, or maybe the upside is, there's now 145 different career options versus just six. And the, you know, the 146th option is entrepreneurship, where you just build something completely new. So that's like a endless possibility. But it's in my view, it's a similar process of you know, coffee chats with people. And I that's kind of how I view both of our shows, is just recorded coffee chats with different career paths and getting a sense of like, okay, do I like this person or do I like what they're describing? And then ideally you can do little miniature experiments. Maybe, you know, maybe you're listening and you're on active duty and you don't have 3 months to go work somewhere, but hey, maybe you could take a week of vacation and go work somewhere and go shadow some CEO. Like, and a week of data is a lot of information. That's like probably, you know, most people listening could listen to or could spend a week on a submarine and definitely rule that out as a career path, or definitely say, this is something I want to dig into deeper. And I've always encouraged people who have that flexibility to do a weekend or a week or a summer or something. Working in a place, the amount of information you get is so key. And if you get that information and you rule out a career option, that is just as valuable as if you get the information and decide, this is what I want to do. But it's just about the exposure. It's just about collecting more data points to inform your next decision. And the other piece of that that I found, and you know, I always think for me with business school, myself and everyone I know, we worked so hard to write convincing applications to schools, talking about what we wanted to do for a career, and we got it wrong. And so then our first internship, we scrambled to find our ideal career, and we do that, and then we got it wrong. And then we scramble our second year to find our first post-MBA job, and we get it wrong. And it's just, you know, it's just kind of, I think all of us at each stage were expecting we were going to find the career that we would do for the next 30 years. And in truth, you find something you do for a year or two, you get more data points that inform your decision making, and you choose something else. And I view it more now as these lily pads where you're just leaping from one to the other. And that is the process. You're just getting information and opening or closing doors. But it's not like you're going to, it's not a once and done process. And that's one of the things I interviewed this guy, Andy Chan, recently. He was the director of career management at Stanford while I was there. And that was part of his point is this job search that you're doing when you first get out of the military, the truth is for 99% of people in the world, that job search you are going to do at least 6 or 7 different times in your career. And so you might as well get good at it. You might as well put some effort into it that first time of learning how to do it, because it's a process you're going to have to repeat multiple times. And that's, you know, partly because we just as human beings, we change over time, and you get more information and more insight about what you like, and you get maybe closer and closer. But the thought that you would just nail it off the start is, I think, putting a little bit too much pressure on oneself.
For sure. And I think that there's a couple of ways to offer some security there, one of which being to find a company that can give you some maneuvering room in order to change careers internally. You know, and I think a lot of folks follow that intuition and they go into development programs or they go to large, you know, publicly traded companies that have enough of a geographic footprint to expose them to different sectors of the economy if they wanted to be. And that's I think, a great option. But also setting yourself up for the financial security where if you're not moving internally within one company, you have the ability to change, you know, leases and commutes and grocery bills and, you know, all these things that go into moving around to be where the job is. I think a lot of people paint themselves in a corner on spending and personal habits in that regard where they don't have the opportunity to fail at a job, right? They say, I got out of the Navy, moved to my hometown, bought a house that was the exact amount of money that a lieutenant can afford, and now I need to find a job that pays that. And that excludes so many options. And it's a rational notion. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, especially if you're married and want to have kids. But
yeah, I love that. I love that. That's a great point about the joining a company that gives you that flexibility to grow and change location or functional role or things like that. That's awesome. And I really love what you're saying too about that financial piece. I know when this is, you know, a while back when I was in San Francisco, my wife and I lived in this 287 square foot apartment that she owned, just super tiny place. You know, submarines were good training for that. But one of the things I respected about Rebecca was she said, look, you know, our rent, it was something absurd. Like the mortgage was like $1,000 a month. And, you know, that equivalent place would honestly be $3,000 a month in rent. And what she would say was, you know, by living here, you're getting the freedom to do whatever you want. You can run and grow your company, and if you don't enjoy that, you can start another company, or you can take time to do soul searching and find your next career. But that, this is giving us the freedom to pursue exactly what we want. And I don't think I appreciated that fully at the time, but it's so true, which is, you know, the degree to which you can either build up your savings or live below your means or both, that gives you time and flexibility to do what you want. And you know, and as an example, I recently joined another startup over here in Denver and took a significant pay cut to do so. And because I built up my savings, I'm able to do that comfortably. But had I not done that, I would not have the freedom to choose this as exactly what I wanted to do. And every once in a while, I'll talk to someone who's like, you know, I'm looking for my dream job straight out of the military. And it's like, okay, well, how long can you last without a paycheck? About 6 weeks. Well, right. You know, it really limits your possibilities unless, you know, if you've got 6 months, 8 months, then you've got time to really turn over some stones and really investigate and play career Sherlock Holmes of you know, finding clues to find what you want to do. But 6 weeks is just not a lot of time. And so I really love that you're highlighting the financial piece, because I think that's such a massive component of all of this.
Right. And I think there's not a whole lot of folks that, you know, people's money, it's a touchy subject. And yeah. I found when talking to military veterans, when we do that initial conversation on the intake and say, okay, hey, so you're going to work with us and we're going to help you find work, what kind of money are you looking to make? This is, you know, I would spend the whole conversation setting up to this, trying to figure out how do I get this topic out there where we're not going to have any kind of, you know, bad feelings over it, because there's sometimes a very real, like you just said, a very real calculus where you take a big pay cut in order to be exposed to an opportunity that has opportunity value, but that it's not, you know, cash, right? So, and there's, it's really hard to say what opportunity value looks like before you jump into it, because, you know, like, well, what if the company doesn't work? What if this industry goes out of business? What if tomorrow Google announces that their AI does everything that this company does and, you know, it's free to the world? You're like, oh, no. Nobody ever gets to know that, though, right? I mean, that certainty is what you have when you're, you know, 90 years old and you're looking back and you're telling your great grandkids about, you know, back when we didn't have robots doing all our jobs for us, you know, this is what I had to do to get, you know, money.
Yeah.
Having real reasonable expectations about finances and then certainly being prepared, that's not something that's specific to veterans. That's good practice. And I think just like seeking out career mentors and being able to engage with people about the life choices you're making to direct your career, it's important to have financial mentors. And probably have those be separate people insofar as you can, again, have kind of comparative information. So somebody who you consider to be highly successful, sort of like the rich dad, poor dad mentality, right? I had this one dad that was well off and I had this other dad that wasn't. Mm. That's super critical, because then you can start to see sort of the pros and cons of either viewpoint and be able to say, well, this guy told me to do this with my money and it made a whole lot of sense. And then I talked to this other guy and he sort of disagreed. So here's this, you know, 60-40 middle ground that I'm going to take. That's going to be my way of doing it.
That's that. I love that, man. I love that idea of the financial mentor, the financial role model. And it made me realize that I have kind of advisors and mentors in different areas, but not particularly in finance. And I can think of literally in the last 2 years, one time that I reached out to just an exceptionally successful investor or friend of mine to ask about investing advice. And it's like this, when you said that, it made me realize like, wow, that's like something that I don't take advantage of. That's like such great advice to have those financial models to learn from. I love that quote that's success leaves clues. And I feel like for so much of my career in entrepreneurship, I remember even saying with startups, it's like, well, you learn by mistake. And, you know, that's true. That's you definitely learn a lot by mistakes. It's a very painful and very expensive way to learn. And, you know, after 5 years of entrepreneurship, I started to put the dots together of like, maybe instead of making mistakes, maybe I could learn from others who have made those mistakes, and started finding these mentors and advisors to learn from. And it's such a more efficient way to get that knowledge. And that could be through podcasts and books or meetings. There's so many exciting ways today to be able to find these mentors and advisors. But when you said that, I realized like, wow, that is a massive area of my life, my finances. And I haven't applied the same rigor or discipline there that I have in career aspects. So I love that you highlight that of finding these financial river guides to help us on that journey.
And that's something that I think, you know, you take twin brothers that are both equally successful, happy, self-actualized person or people, and slap one of them with $150,000 with a credit card debt, right? Mm-hmm. And see how those two people who have identical DNA become totally different in the real mm-hmm. world, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to deal with those issues.
Yep.
And so that's who you bring to the job, right? That's who you introduce to the employer. And, you know, I don't know if this is funny or not funny. I mean, at the time, it was sort of just flabbergasting that I talked to a candidate once and I asked him what he wanted to make. And he gave me a number that, you know, quite honestly, I could have probably pulled a zero off the back end of it and we would have been closer to the mark. And I asked him, I said, look, I gotta tell you, I don't know if that amount of money is a realistic expectation, you know, for anyone, I didn't say.
Yeah. But,
and he said to me, well, look, I mean, I have five investment properties that I bought in 2008 all around the country when I was on the active duty earning BAH. That's how much money I need in order to keep the mortgages paid on those five properties. And it didn't seem to register to this individual that that's not the responsibility of, you know, Acme Incorporated to deal with your investment mistakes. There is a remedy to those five underwater properties, right? It might not be the one you want, but had that person not had that issue, they could have come to the table and said, hey, look, here's this different number that's much more reasonable. Now let's move forward. And so however much time that occupies or however much attention it occupies, however it alters your psychology and, you know, probably down to a very biological, chemical basis creates, you know, negative outcomes for you with your business environment, the people around you.
Yeah, it's so true too. And it's the... I realize more and more how much stress inhibits my own creativity and how stress prohibits me from seeing possibilities and options. And I can think of the times, whether it's finance or other areas of stress in my life, when that is most acute, that's when my performance is the worst. And it's like, if you're approaching your career like Olympians approach their sport, you want to make sure that you're functioning at that optimal level. And to do that, it's like, you know, if you're an extreme athlete, your nutrition is dialed in, your sleep is dialed in. Like these are the foundational elements that allow you to be world class. And I think, at least for me, and I would extract that this is probably true for most people, when I am stressed out of my mind about keeping my five properties afloat or whatever is giving me financial stress, that's going to limit logistically the offers that I can take, but it's also going to really change my mindset. It's going to change how I'm showing up in interviews. It's going to change how I'm showing up in my day-to-day in a way that's going to keep me from being my personal best.
And that's something I've heard on your show as well, is this mindset of how to sell yourself in the job interview and what are the ways to do that convincingly without seeming like you're trying to, you know, get somebody to buy a clunker used car. Right. So that ability to say, hey, we're going to have this conversation, and if it doesn't result in an employment offer, that's okay. In fact, that might be a good outcome given the way the conversation goes and how that relationship evolves over time.
I love that.
But a lot of folks, again, if they're in this position where there's some sort of stressor that's being applied externally that could have been mitigated through more planning, I've seen the impact of that, and it can sometimes be very devastating to people. However, yeah. that negative experience can in and of itself kind of be that cathartic moment where people say, look, that did not work at all. And here we are 6 months later. What am I going to do about it?
Yeah, and I love when you're saying that, it makes me think, too, of the advantage I've seen from people who take the long view on their career. And this guy, Jimmy Sopko, I think it was the second interview I did. He got out of the military after like 5 to 7 years and went to Pinterest in San Francisco. But he started as like a customer support person. And I'm guessing he was making like 40 grand a year. And so, and I, you know, probably before that, I don't know, in the military, maybe 120. I mean, it was like a just complete fraction of what he was making before. And not just the financial piece, but the title was, you know, just an entry level position. Everyone around him was like straight out of college. He was commanding warships, and now he's next to like some 22-year-old, you know, and it was just a blow to pride in many ways. But that step back allowed him over time to rapidly accelerate in the organization. And he's had an incredible career in tech since then. And so that, and then the other piece I always think of is one of my instructors at business school, Joel Peterson. He's the chairman of JetBlue Airlines Board of Directors, incredibly successful. But he always used to say, look, you'll make the most money in your career between age 40 and 50. And so everything is just about lining yourself up so that when you hit age 40, you are just in the spot to crush it. And both of those stories make me think of like, man, if you can take the long game in your career, I'm so often in the rush. I want to get to the end state. I want to be in that end job. But I kind of look back on myself and in some of the people I've interviewed, it's like, if you could just take a few deep breaths and approach this as, you know, lily pads, I'm going to do this. I'm going to obtain these skill sets. Then I'm going to do this next thing and obtain these skill sets, and then do this next thing and obtain these skill sets. And then I'm going to be in the position to do things. And that's not to say like putting your dreams on hold, but taking the long game of, you know, really preparing for this, for your long-term career rather than just being fixated on what's next. And that's something I, you know, advice I would wish I could give to myself in retrospect, but also I've seen that consistently across people I've interviewed, of just slowing down and not feeling like you have to nail it the first time.
Yeah. And I've maybe to adapt that analogy a bit, this is maybe another way to think of that. If you get out of the military with no civilian experience after however much time, and the very first job you accept is 50% of what you would define as, you know, a perfect situation. So half of your life feels like it's out of whack, and the other half you feel like you've got it pretty well managed. Okay, fine. And then two to three years later, right, you've gone through some certifications, some industry experience, tons of interpersonal relationships that have expanded your level of knowledge. Maybe now you're at 60 to 70%. Maybe you accept a new position or receive a title change or promotion, or you leave the company, you find another job, and you get to 75, 85%. And maybe at the 10-year mark, you're at 85% of where you expect it to be. Well, that's really, really good. You know, that's extremely good, because a career is not defined by any single snapshot point in time. Or, you know, anybody can have any job title for, you know, one day and seem entirely credible, right? I could go on LinkedIn right now and change my job title to the, you know, the president and founder of Mossholder Incorporated. And great. And for that day, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, like, what did you do the next day, right? Did it go anywhere? Did you do anything? Did it mature anywhere? So I think thinking in terms of that larger picture and say, hey, by the time I'm done working, I want to be able to say that what I figured out how to do after 20, 30, 40 years of gainful employment was exactly where I thought I would be, or it was really, really close. You know, 100% isn't the standard, you know. Mm-hmm. If you were to visit with somebody on their deathbed and say, you know, you only got 95% of the way there, how do you feel? They'd be like, what are you talking about? You know, I lived my life. I had this experience that's unique for one person at any given time.
I think that's such a great framework, the 50%. Like, I love the way you said that. It's like, if your first job, you got 50% of it right, that's awesome. And right. Just go from there. That, like, when I hear you say that, it takes off so much of the pressure of trying to get for this mythical 100%. But it's like, man, if you get a couple things right in that first job, you know, maybe the only thing that you extract from it is, I like this industry, or I like working with these people, or I really don't like this size of company. That's great, valuable data. And there's not as much pressure to get every single thing dialed in perfectly the first time.
I think an important exercise is to figure out what features of employment you'd want to put in that positive 50%. It's kind of interesting that you mentioned Jimmy Sopko, because he and I worked together as candidate and recruiter. I think my notes go back to the 4th of June, 2012. So okay. I'd been a civilian for all of 3 days the first time I left him a voicemail.
Yeah.
And I remember having a couple conversations about, you know, thinking about going in the marketing direction and looking at tech, West Coast location primarily, you know, things like that. And then eventually our notes end when he accepted that job with Pinterest 7 months later. So in a way, right, he got what he was looking for, and then you caught up with him later and things had progressed in a favorable direction. And that's a guy who kind of had a plan for himself to go into that and say, this is the thing that I want to try to get right. Right. The money we can wiggle on, but I need to get this one element into the right bucket right mm-hmm. out of the gate. And I think if you've done the right kind of self-analysis to say, maybe, and I'll tell you, in my case, I differed from him in that I wasn't picky on my industry or my kind of functional area, but I wanted to be at a company where I could identify by name the people in proximity to my desk that I thought I was going to gain knowledge from, that I could earn, you know, some sort of a mentorship relationship with, because that's what I thought I needed and ultimately definitely needed, you know, in retrospect. And so when you say to yourself, okay, well, hey, look, if I make a list of 10 things I want in a job, which are the 5 that I'm you know, going to kind of hold fast to, or 4 or 3 or just 1 maybe, right? I need to have a mentor identified that's managing my career progression. And then, you know, the rest, I could be a nice supervisor at a manure factory for all I care, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've decided early on what are those features, those are the people that in the, you know, kind of large data set of interactions I've had, they're the ones who seem to get where they want to be, however much time that ends up taking, versus folks who kind of prioritize other stuff. Say, hey, I want that high-paying job that's going to be with that well-known brand. Well, okay, sure. You need to work with whatever people are going to surround you at that high-paying job at that well-known brand, because that's not the thing you get to choose if you've already decided that you want those other features to be locked down.
Oh, man, I 1,000% agree with that. And I would say, in the 180 plus interviews I've done, the number one common piece of advice that I've heard from veterans is around the importance of self-knowledge and knowing what your priorities are. And tactical way to achieve that, and we actually, for Beyond the Uniform, we have like a new coaching program now where we connect you with subsidized coaches to help you in this, but coaching seems to be an effective way to really drill down and figure out what those values are that are driving your decisions. And I remember in grad school, this professor gave this analogy. It's kind of a overused analogy, but it is powerful, that's thought of, you know, if you have a vase and you want to fill it, you put the rocks in, and then you put the gravel in, and then you put the sand in, and then you put water in, but you have to start with the rocks. And being not only having that self-knowledge, for me, more and more as I think about this, it boils down to honesty. Like, can I really be honest about what does matter most? Is it location? Is it the functional role? Maybe, in that analogy you were given, maybe I can be honest with myself and say, you know what, I really care right now what other people think. And so I want a job at a well-known institution. And I hate that that's true, but I really, really care about what other people think about me. So being honest about that and letting that be okay, but then it allows you to rank order those priorities. And, the lens sometimes I look through it is you've got location, you've got title, or the functional role in a company, you've got the industry, you've got, salary, work-life balance. It's kind of putting the top two, and you can kind of make decisions around that, but it's unlikely you'll get all six of those characteristics. But if you know, it just makes it easier. If you're getting out of the military and you say, I love San Diego, so that is the stake I'm putting in the ground. Oftentimes, vets that I talk to, they're so hesitant to rule things out. They say, I'm a jack of all trade. I'm a Swiss Army knife. I'll do anything. And when you say that, it's like, I can't help you. Like the mental Rolodex, it's just impossible to see where I can fit you in. But if you tell me like, hey, I am dead set on San Diego and I want to work at a 10 to 50 person company in the food space, well, then that's something that's so actionable. I can connect you with someone, or I can give advice, or I can be really tactical on that. And so that self-knowledge and the explicit priorities just make it so much easier for you to find what you want and for others to help you obtain that.
I think a lot of people cringe at this idea that they're going to go into like talk therapy and be super honest about their feelings and stuff, especially from the veteran community, because it's not something that's like, you know, people don't solicit your emotional health all the time in the military, you know? And there's a lot of value in it, right? There's a lot of value in putting yourself in an uncomfortable interaction with a mentor or a coach or a therapist or a psychologist, where you are forced to encounter, you know, differing viewpoints about the way you're kind of processing your worldview. And I think once you do that, you can see on the back end, you're like, okay, yeah, that was worthwhile doing, right? You know, maybe we got a little touchy-feely for a little while there, but I think I know some things that I can then go, like you said, it's actionable now to go out there and find these sorts of to prioritize your company search that way.
It is, and it's so baffling to me when I hear that, because I hear that so often. I understand that there is a lot of pushback to it, but I always think of like Tiger Woods saying like, oh, I don't want someone watching my backswing and critiquing me, or you know, Usain Bolt saying like, I don't want someone looking at me when I come off the blocks and giving me advice. It's like the best performance athletes in the world, they have multiple coaches who are looking at them. They're pointing out things that the person doesn't see themselves. They're critiquing them. They're giving them the 2% change that makes all the difference in their performance. And I view, for either emotional health or for career success, these coaches, executive coaches, career coaches, therapists, whatever bucket you want to put them in, it is Maslow's highest, it's self-actualization. It's giving you someone who's going to give you the outside observation to allow you to perform at your optimal level. And it's just kind of funny to me, because I think that a lot of people do view it as a weakness rather than like, look, the best people in the world have someone helping them and someone really coaching them through to achieve the next level. And that's to me what therapy or coaching or whatever bucket you want to put it in is.
And you know, if you're, let's say, an infantry company commander in the Marine Corps, you know, you're not necessarily going to the guiding temple of natural light to get this advice, right? So there are different places that you can seek this out. Maybe the best example is, you know, look at a cockpit in a military aircraft that's a multi-seat aircraft. You know, those people don't say, hey, you know, NFO in the backseat, I got it, I'm the pilot, I know what I'm doing, and my competency is directly related to how little I can rely on you as a resource. Mm. You know, that's crazy, right? In fact, your competency is directly related to how much you can rely on each other as resources.
That's great.
And there's a framework for that. There's a communications protocol. There's a, you know, cultural indoctrination that when you join the aviation community, you learn how to interact as resources in the cockpit. There's rules on paper, and there's unspoken rules within the community. And there are organizations like yours, like mind that we are veterans talking to veterans about veteran stuff. And so while it's always valuable to find totally unique perspectives and try to incorporate that into your mindset, you want to talk to a SWO about what it's like to be a SWO getting out of the military. Well, first of all, listen to the podcast. And then second of all, you know, give us a shout, because that's the framework that we've set up here. And if you're looking for assistance with, you know, emotional health or recovering from trauma or whatnot, right, there's people that they've dedicated their lives to making that available to veterans and to people out there. So I think really being in tune with what the resources are and then having the courage to ask for them, whether or not it's something that's, you know, problematic, or you're thinking to yourself, I need that next step. I need to level up somehow. Where do I go with that? You know, even if you just wander onto any random college campus near you and find the Veteran Services Office and say, hey, what do y'all got? I was in the military once. There's always going to be that framework. And there's so many of them now. We're, you know, 17 years post 9/11, and there's been almost two decades of development in this space.
That's awesome. I love it.
Well, Justin, I want to be cautious of your time here. We're at about an hour. Is there anything you want to finish up with, or maybe kind of put your brand out there so folks know how to get a hold of you and look at your resources and take advantage of that stuff?
Just collecting my thoughts. You know, definitely at beyondtheuniform.io, there's a ton of different interviews there. One section that just comes to mind is there's I categorize some of the interviews by resources. And you know, talking with you, Tim, I'm even more aware now of there are so many incredible resources out there. There are so many great people who want to help the military community, and I know it can be difficult to find them or to kind of navigate through that. So I would recommend maybe checking out the resources section, because there's a lot of great nonprofits and for-profits who are just trying to solve some problem for you, whether that's the career search or finances or whatever it is. And so, I would recommend you check that out. And if those organizations resonate with you, you know, check them out. If you're thinking of grad school, Service to School is a great organization. Or for anyone, a free resource, American Corporate Partners. I interviewed them a way back, but they connect you with mentors for free. And so it's kind of like a buffet of, you know, so many different options, and just kind of sample through them and see which ones connect with you. Not all of them will, but the ones that do, take advantage of that. You have earned that with your military service. You've done a great, great act, for our country. And, I know a lot of, the people I interview, that element of service runs deep, and they can feel selfish for doing things that, in my view, are not selfish at all. It's just kind of being honest about their needs and prioritizing their own needs, oftentimes for the first time in a long time. And so as you're thinking of this career transition, be okay being selfish, be okay putting your needs and your family's needs first. And one way to do that is to take up these offers for help. And there's a lot of people that want to help you. Just kind of figure out which one you want to work with and experiment. If it doesn't work well, try another one, because there are lots and lots of people out there offering free things for you to help you out.
Yeah, as one of those people, we're all dying to hear from you. I don't know anybody who's in this space doing this sort of work who's like, yeah, I don't know, we'll hear from that guy later, right? We want to hear from you now. Well, Justin, thanks so much for your time, man. This has been really interesting and fun. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Uniform. There are over 200 free episodes at beyondtheuniform.io. They're classified by the industry of focus, the functional role the person plays, and more. Beyond the Uniform is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our Director of Outreach, responsible for sponsorship and guest episodes, is Steve Bain. Our Editor, responsible for the show notes and text transcripts for all episodes, is Kathleen Dillon. Our Data Analytics and Insights Advisor is Andrew Woolridge. If you are enjoying Beyond the Uniform, you can help us out by telling your veterans and friends in the military about this free resource. There is more information on the website about how you can sponsor an episode or donate to our program to help us grow the work that we're doing. Be sure to check out the coaching section of beyonduniform.io, where you can be paired with professional, subsidized coaches to help you figure out your next career move. You can sign up for our newsletter to be up to date on the latest happenings at Beyond the Uniform. And in each show notes section, there is a link to audible.com, which is providing a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. You get a free book of your choosing, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to subsidize the cost of the show, regardless of whether you can continue with audible.com or not. Check that out and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep the feedback coming. Let me know what resources would help you in your career, and we'll do our best to make that happen. Take care, be safe, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career.